Okay, today we're happy to have Doug Rich from
Okay. So actually, I think we already had the most interesting talk today, and hopefully this won't be this won't be too bad. I just want to illustrate the state of the art here as it stands. These are the yeah. I'm going to see if I can demonstrate that as well.
There has to be a secondary.
Right. Right, and probably I can get it higher too, right? Okay, and in order to get a point on this graph, you have to be a galaxy. You have to have a well-measured central dark mass that's unresolved at whatever resolution it's been studied. And the mass has been estimated invariably in these 15 cases and these two, and there's a third one that goes down there in some of the plots, by basically RV squared over G times the fudge factor that depends on the method. And and you don't see light associated with the, or at least you don't see stars that could produce the mass that's determined in that way. And let's see, I got this equation wrong yesterday during Wandel's talks, but I think it's right there. Roger caught it. Okay. Of course, I've always learned that black holes are like elementary particles because they have three quantum numbers, charge, mass, and spin. And so, like an elementary particle experimentalist, I have lots of collaborators. So that's the gang. And I'm taking advantage of the fact that I think many of you heard the first half of the talk that I always want to give at the black hole meeting February. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about individual objects, which I normally do, and which leads me not to get to the second half of the talk, which is more interesting. So today you really get the second half of the talk without the first half of the talk. And I hope that those of you that heard the talk in February are persuaded that for those 15 objects I flashed earlier, the evidence is pretty good that there's unseen dark matter in the center of those galaxies that's consistent with a black hole, and I hope the rest of you are black hole partisans anyway. So, but I do want to remind everybody of the connection to quasars. In a number of cases, and these are some of the prettiest ones, you can examine a quasar. These are moderate to low redshift quasars. Many of them are PG objects. In which you can recognize that there's a quasar from the diffraction pattern. These are Hubble telescope pictures. And you can actually resolve the host galaxy underneath the quasar. And there are all kinds, right? There's a spiral, there's an elliptical, and there are several interacting galaxies. And I think this, in fact, is a foreground star, so there's even room for Chip Arp if he still wishes to make an argument.
A few years ago, there was a flap about quasars not in host galaxies. Did all that just go away?
Well, I think most of that had to do with the principal investigator on a famous Hubble observing program not understanding surface brightness very well.
I'm just asking if it all went away.
And
his press conference, yes. Two press conferences. Yes. One that said they weren't there, and the second one said they were. Same day.
He was right.
But the more interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, is: are there any cases where you have a very stringent limit on a quasar where you really do not see a host galaxy, and it's disturbing that you don't see a host galaxy? And I don't know that. Do you know that?
7C is undiluted, I believe that statement is made.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's the statement. Again, I'm not sure what the quantitative measure is.
It's still, I think the reason it's interesting to discover a hostless quasar is because you might suppose that you had a black hole that was a triple in a galaxy and it got ejected by a three-body interaction, carrying the accretion disk along with it for a while. Oh, that's certainly true, but you've got to have some chicken to accrete onto it.
Yeah, but it may not be stars, so.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. Right.
How long
would
such a disk last?
Well, 10 to the 6 years, 10 to the 7 years, I don't know. Not long. Okay. So, if you believe quasars are accreting black holes in galaxies, then the local energy density is interesting. And this, this sort of argument will be completely familiar to everyone who was at Paolo's talk on Tuesday. This is the energy density in quasar light, subject to, I think, various uncertainties, which probably make it an underestimate. But this number, and I've written it, I have this rant about how you should discuss surveys, but I've written this number as an energy density, and this is 100 times less than 1 eV per cubic centimeter, which is the microwave background energy density. And when you think about it that way, you can compare it directly to the infrared background that Paolo was talking about, which is 10 times less than the microwave background. So this is about a factor of 10 down, maybe a little bit more, from the infrared, from the energy in the infrared background that was discussed on Tuesday. And these estimates of energy density are really completely cosmologically independent. And if you want to estimate the mass density that's associated with that, there's only a fairly mild dependence on cosmology. You need to know when the energy was radiated because the photons redshift 1 power of 1 plus c faster than the matter density by continuity. And this factor is 3 or 4 for quasars. And if you do that, you can estimate the mass density in the accreted quasar light. And as I say, I think if you thought about the uncertainties in this, I think the biggest uncertainty in this number, which is systematic, is that it's likely. Actually, I think there are two uncertainties. One uncertainty is I think it's likely that the bolometric corrections were underestimated in this paper, so the energy is likely higher. Turner and Choksi used bolometric corrections of only about a factor of 4, and I think 10 is probably the best guess.
The obscured ones.
Plus the obscured ones, right? That might be important. And the other thing is, absolutely. That was the thing I was going to say. I was going to say that also. That is, all we know about in terms of the redshift evolution is the bright end of the luminosity function. And the assumption in this is that the faint ones track. That is, the luminosity function has the same shape. And I think that's tremendously dangerous. But I'm not absolutely certain that that's an underestimate. And I think that leads this to be an underestimate. But I think it is true that with the luminosity function that's assumed, most of this energy comes out near the high end rather than the low end.
There's another factor of a few that you might consider. I believe that even the unobscured quasars are obscured in the sense that most of their energy is absorbed along the line. In fact, here's the evidence. The smoke of a low dominant radio loud quasar is a sensitive function of the R parameter and therefore the orientation. And the more edge of
Dad, what's the R parameter?
The core over total.
Oh, okay.
Lobe or something. So the lower that parameter and the more you might expect to be edge on, the redder the continuum. And there's evidence that that is because of reddening, because in some cases the Bonner decrement is there. Anyway, if that's true, the lobe dominant optically visible quasars has significant absorption in the optical and therefore great majority of absorption in the UV wave.
Okay. Okay. Now, usually when I give this talk, I spend a lot of time talking about stellar dynamics. I just want to point out that there are now actually quite a number of gas dynamical and Maser cases. And let me remind you of this one, which is not the famous M87 case, but a much less famous case, M84, which was actually one of the first disks spectrograph observations with Space Telescope. There were a series of observations made with the slit oriented this way across the face of this almost obscured, right, see the dust lane, center of this galaxy, and there were several flanking observations. The H-alpha line does not do this, right? You'd have to absorb very close to the black hole, right? The real amplitude of the velocity is a couple of hundred kilometers a second. And here's what the velocity looks like for the fastest moving clouds in the center in the model, which fits these observations so well, is a Keplerian disk, you know, quite inclined to that. So that's quite a good fit to that model. And you can't change the mass of this object by more than 10% or so. Sorry? There are two sets of emitting clouds. That is, you see two humps in the line. And some of it appears to be more slowly moving gas, along the line of sight anyway, that's projected in front of the nucleus of the galaxy.
And
the scale? Let's see. An arc second in this galaxy is about 20 parsecs. And this is down to around... Sorry, is about 4 parsecs or 3 parsecs. And, no, about 20 parsecs. And this is down to a tenth of an arc second resolution. So about 4 tenths, 20 to 2 parsecs. Okay, and then I just have to show you the famous case. This is the Maser Galaxy 4258. This isn't a picture you usually see. This is in the optical. This is a dust lane from the disk of the galaxy. The main disk of the galaxy is inclined. The Maser disk in the middle is actually oriented edge on to us, which is pretty astonishing good luck. So the Maser disk is clearly tipped relative to the disk of the galaxy. And again, you get a superb Keplerian fall off down to about a fifth of a parsec. And I wanted to show that because the other point I want to make is that if you make that same plot of black hole mass against bulge galaxy light, and you color code the observations, right? So the Maser disks are red, the gas disks observed with hydrogen lines are green, and the stellar dynamical ones are black, and we can make our galaxy all colors. If one accepts this sort of normalization or correlation with the black hole mass and the bulge mass, then beyond that, you see little evidence for a separation of the methods. It's well known that it's much more easy to discover gas disks in elliptical galaxies that are very massive than in low mass ones like M32. But apart from that, you don't see a tendency for these different methods to give very different masses, which leads me to believe that systematic errors in these methods, which are bound to be rather different and probably worse for the stellar dynamical case, systematic errors are certainly not bigger and probably smaller than the scatter, which is about a factor of 10. Okay, I guess the next thing I'd like to do is I'd like to mention the astrophysical constraints on aggregate systems, because, you know, you can demonstrate, we're really probing these objects in the Newtonian limit, and so you can demonstrate that there's a big lump of dark stuff, but you can't demonstrate easily, at least, that it's a black hole as opposed to a cluster of degenerate objects, cluster of white dwarfs. But there are some nice astrophysical constraints which have considerable bite in three cases, in M32, 4258 Maser case, the famous Maser case, and our own galaxy. And these have been worked out in the literature by A.O. Mouse, and I want to give you a cartoon view, sort of my cartoon view of how these constraints work. It's actually, I think it's actually an interesting subject and may merit some more thinking. The first constraint you can apply, if you imagine you've got a massive thing that you don't see, whose size and mass are constrained. And so the first thing you might ask are, if you make this out of a bunch of gravel or stars, what's the physical collision time? Because at least if you make it out of ordinary stars, the typical physical collision speed will be hundreds of kilometers a second. The escape velocity from a non-degenerate star is several hundred kilometers a second. So they'll stick. You get a flash when they hit. They'll stick. If these physical collisions occur frequently, you'll build up a fairly massive star, and then a little supernova. And this will keep going on, and certainly you'll be able to observe this massive object doing this. It might be a way, well, I don't know whether it's a good way to make a black hole or not, but certainly you can observe it. So the constraint is that the collision time for a typical star has to be much less than a Hubble time, and basically this is n sigma v, right? And then there's a gravitational focusing term which is not very big, a couple.
Let's see, what about the variant of that where one of the victims is a red giant? You see red giants?
Oh, well, if the stars are red giants, if you have an appreciable red giant population, they'll collide even more often because bigger.
Yeah.
And actually, I suppose if they just brush, they can go through each other. But they'll spew that part of the envelope off into space. And, I think basically you wind up tearing off the envelopes, and then you can discuss how the cores of red giants evolve. So that that might be worth thinking about. No, that certainly hasn't gone into this. If you have a reasonable stellar,
look at that.
It's a model for quasars.
Right.
Yeah, but I mean, sort of make some estimates about
the point is, though, 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4 of the stars in a normal evolving population will be red giants anyway. So you have all the others to worry about. Okay, so anyway, I just parameterized this in terms of this formula, in terms of the central density of the objects, the density of the enclosed invisible mass, the size of it in parsecs, and the masses of the objects that you make this out of, and also the density of the objects. And what you get, which is kind of interesting, is you get for 10 to the 8 solar masses per cubic parsec, which is achieved in all these cases, you get a collision rate of about 10 collisions per Hubble time. For this size scale, and these are actually a little smaller, and for a mass anywhere near a solar mass with a fairly slow dependence, but there is a much faster dependence on the density of the stars. Now, what this means is you basically can't kill this by making these stars brown dwarfs or even planets, right, as long as they have comparable to a solar density. But you can beat this constraint by making these objects degenerate, because then you get densities a million times up. and that suppresses this by a factor of 10 to the 4. So that's one way up. You can make clusters of degenerate objects. The other way you can do this, the other way you can beat this problem, is you can make this, you can make these objects clusters of neutrinos, or some non-interacting particle. And in fact, you can beat the degeneracy constraint for neutrinos for these if the neutrinos have masses like 10 or 20 eV. So it's not ridiculous if you can figure out a way to do it. So they might be neutrino balls. Yeah, that's the point. That's the degeneracy there is, but only just, and if the neutrinos are around 10 or 20 eV. Well, people have been writing papers on it. Yeah.
Does that collision calculation take into account dynamical friction
also? No. That's next. I'm going to talk about relaxation. It's close cousin. Okay, so then what you can do is you can say, okay, I'll make these objects out of, I'll make these dark clusters out of degenerate objects. So they're point masses for purposes of that. What about two-body relaxation? You know, two-body gravitational scattering of the individual objects. And the rate at which that changes the energies in the individual objects is that, right, where this is, that's G, that's the mass of the dominant mass type star. You could repeat this for mass spectrum. That's the number density, and that's their mean speed cubed, and that's a factor of 10. And if you do this, and I checked it last night, and I actually had this correct, but I got it wrong twice. So anyway, the rate at which this proceeds is 10 to the minus 8 per year times the mass in solar units of the stars you make your aggregate out of divided by the square root of the mass in 10 to the 8 solar masses, units of 10 to the 8 solar masses. These guys are all around 10 to the 7 to the 1/2, so that's a weak dependence. And there's a weak dependence on the there's a pretty strong dependence on the size of the object, but these things are all constrained to occupy radii less than a parsec. So this in the denominator makes things faster. And this varies, the rate slows down as you go to lower mass objects or bigger, a bigger aggregate lump, because two-body relaxation is basically a graininess effect. It's the scattering of the lumps off each other. And basically, you get relaxation times faster than 10 to the minus 8 per year in these three objects. And if you, that means in Hubble time, you can go 100 relaxation times, and that's sufficient to evaporate away most of the mass by populating the Maxwellian tail of the distribution and having those stars escape, and then and possibly also binding a small fraction of the mass that you started with into a black hole. So this might be a way to, you know, it's a pretty unlikely way, I think, to make the black holes that you see in these systems. But it suggests that unless you go to objects that are around a tenth of a solar mass or less, you can't escape having black holes by putting the objects in degenerate objects. I don't have a clue how to make a degenerate object of a tenth of a solar mass by stellar evolution. I suppose you might be able to make one-tenth solar mass black holes, but I also don't have a clue how to make those. So black holes are a pretty good bet, I think. In fact, I think the sort of the only sensible alternative for the centers of these objects is massive neutrinos, is balls of massive neutrinos. And I don't understand how you could possibly extract the energy, you know, from massive neutrinos to get such a tight cluster of them in the center of a galaxy.
Why not?
Oh, well, that's the same sort of thing, right?
No, you don't have the space basically. Well, you don't have
the space. Oh, yeah, that's actually easier with WIMPs. That's right.
I'm surprised it works.
Well, it, I can't remember the name of this paper, but it has been done in the FJ. Quite right. But I can't remember their names. Can you? Either of them?
I can't remember their names.
But I have checked. I was so flabbergasted when I saw this. They do investigate the degeneracy constraint, and it's a straightforward calculation, and I checked it, and it's right.
It's just funny, because the dwarf galaxies is a serious constraint.
Well, the reason they're
not that extreme, but this is way more.
You have more, you have more velocity. Here, you have more phase, you have more velocity phase space. You have less volume, but you have more velocity phase.
They have moderate
flow over BQ.
Right.
You have one that's about a million solar masses, yet they have moderate but not extremely deep gravitational potential well. And so they want to use this as an alternative to Attis to get low accretion efficiency in a thin disk. So they actually propose this as a model for the galactic center because they don't want too much gravitational binding energy being released.
It's
no black hole. It's not an ADAP anymore.
That's right. It's an alternative to an ADAP.
That's right.
So Andy should sue them for contract.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry. But anyway.
Okay. But it does. I don't think there's an error in the paper.
Yeah. No.
You've checked it too.
I read one of them. And
oh, it's your fault, right?
I can't send it to me for a minute.
You mean you wanted to support the ADAP model?
No, I thought it sounded implausible.
Yeah. Well, I think it does.
It must be true that black holes are far and away the conservative interpretation of the observation.
It is an irony. It is an irony that in this subject, black holes have become the conservative model.
Yeah.
Well,
it's just that's right. Imagination.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah. Right. Generation.
Yeah. I think they would die off.
Okay. Now we talk about Magorian's paper, right? Because Emery Wandell discussed it a lot yesterday, and I, if you look at this correlation, the thing which everybody tumbles to pretty quickly is, I'll come back to this, but is that, well, look, guys, M32 and the galaxy and M31 are right here next door to us. And these galaxies are pretty far away, and there is no way, if you looked at a galaxy in the Virgo cluster, like this one or this one, that's 16 megaparsecs away, or in the Leo group, like that one or that one, which is 10 megaparsecs away, there's no way you'd discover a 10 to the 6th black hole, 10 to the 6th solar mass black hole. So because of the spatial resolution of the observations at the same angular resolution that you make on nearby galaxies. So there's simply no way you could discover objects down here in this sample. How do you know this whole area down in here, under here is not populated? Yeah, it is, but I'll come back to that.
Because that suggests that the number down there is only 3. So.
Yes. Right. That's right. That's the argument. So now let me make it a little more formally. This is exactly what we tried to do in Magorian's paper. And Magorian's a Bayesian, and I'm not. So I have a different way of looking at Magorian's paper, and I want to explain it. But I think you can look at this as being a little bit like the V over Vmax problem. You have a list of objects and that you decide that you can go out to investigate, and you can predict in advance, if you have a model, which of them will have black holes you can discover in them and which of them won't, and you can test that prediction. And there's a nice way of doing that by a maximum likelihood method, and let me just describe that in some detail. So the idea is, you know, my view of Magorian et al. Is that you imagine that you have a statistical model of the probability of finding... Sorry, are you objecting to the fact that I'm not a Bayesian?
No, I'm just
We think you are.
You would also be going back to Begg's theorem, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yes, I understand this argument. The fact is, it's the statement that when you do a problem with Bayesian methods, if you can also do it with, if you actually believe the result, you can invariably do it with a frequentist method, like maximum likelihood. And in fact, in this case, they're sort of equivalent, right? It's the cases where they give different results that you find yourself scratching your head. But anyway, you get the same result this way. Yeah. A closet Bayesian. Okay, so the idea is you have the statistical model, which, because of that graph, I'm going to assume, makes a prediction based on the black hole mass of the galaxy over the bulge mass of the galaxy about the probability of finding a black hole in the galaxy. And you might imagine that when I go out and collect the data, in some cases, I won't be able to discover, there will be a strong probability that I won't be able to discover a black hole because the galaxy is too far away, or because I know I'm going to get crummy data on that galaxy. And so it has a substantial minimum X where I can't possibly detect a black hole if it's down in that part of the distribution. Yeah.
Different X min for gas and stars.
Absolutely, and different X min for masers. And yes. X min depends on the distance to the candidate galaxy, right? Because the further away it is,
right,
the larger any given angular resolution,
no,
the larger the space. Right.
You have a bunch of, you have the distance argument, but you also have different categories that you're trying to...
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
Now, in fact, so what you have to do... Now, in fact, the way Magorian did it is he restricted himself to stars and to elliptical galaxies. But you could generalize this method in exactly the way that you're thinking, and in fact, I have some hope of doing that.
In a Bayesian way.
Well, I... Perhaps you can persuade me. Right. So... Anyway, now what you need in this probability distribution is you need some probability of success. That is, there has to be some probability that you have a black hole mass of zero, which is sort of the one minus that. And then you have some mean value, and then you have some spread. And you can imagine any function you like for this, but you specify that in this parametric way, right? If Dave Merritt were here, not only are you Bayesian, but you should do this in a non-parametric way, but we've done that too, but anyway. So anyway, if you assume you've got a nice function there, then you can construct a likelihood, right, after you do your experiment. Because for every object that you succeeded with, the probability that you succeeded at that measured value of xi is just that probability. And for every object in which you failed, the probability that you would have failed is just the integral of this function up to here. And so that's a likelihood, and you have a maximum likelihood method once you have a set of data, and you can vary the parameters and figure out what works. And I actually checked some of Magorian's calculations. And this is what these parameters look like. This is log Gaussian, for example. These are two different power laws. This is a Schechter function. That's a Gaussian. And these are sort of the parameters that you get for the centroid of the distribution and the spread in the distribution. And that's not nearly so interesting as the distributions marginalized over everything except x, which are what is shown in these two plots. And so you see we get, for all of the distributions, we get x around half percent or somewhat less by mass. And I'm occulting this periodically. And we basically succeeded in... most of the cases, that is, the value of F that you got, the formal value of F that we got, was 97%. Okay. And so what this is The same plot you've seen before with the nice data up there in big symbols, and the Megorian analyzed data represented as small symbols, because I think any one of them has much less weight, but it's at least it's a well-defined set of objects. And so if there's no selection effect in that, and most of these objects were observed in the 80s before we sort of put them together by scouring the literature, and they were observed in the 80s before people were even thinking about massive black holes in ordinary galaxies, at least before many people were thinking about it. And so there's no obvious selection, although it's not a complete sample in any sense. And I think a lot of the argument you could have about this is with these last few points up at the top here. But everything else, I think, just sort of strengthens one's impressions about this. Well, for Megorian's cases, at least in Megorian's case, that's not a problem, because he's looking at elliptical galaxies.
Yes.
For the other cases, I stand squarely behind the mighty John Cormandy, who is the expert at separating bulge and disk profiles and digging the bulges out. And he's done, for all the big points, he's done them all lovingly. Now, well, there are error bars, and I think you could go back and look at our papers, but they're a lot smaller in most of these cases than the black hole mass error bars. You know, that is.
No, I'm just now, the morphology when John does the subtractions.
Well, most of these galaxies. Well, most of these galaxies we know about, right? There's M31. You have a pretty good idea of how to do the bulge disk decomposition in M31. You could do it, right? Right. Now the hard cases. The hard cases.
I'm wondering what actually he got. You know, because it's not always nice out of the quarter profile and exponential.
Oh yes, and in some of the cases,
where do you draw the line?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I agree. But you know, you're on to the short end of this problem. You've got the dog by the tail. The points that you should really worry about are the Seiferts, right? Because there, not only do you have to dig the bulge out of the disk, you have to reject the light from the AGN in the middle. And so, for example, you know, where you put 1068 and 4258. In the horizontal direction on this figure is much more uncertain than where you put them in the vertical direction. So I think I have a tremendous worry in those cases on the Seiferts in the horizontal direction. But you know, in the case of a galaxy like 3115, there's a, you know, that's a bulge dominated S0 galaxy. The disk is a small fraction of the total light. You could make a significant error and you wouldn't move it much.
So can you actually accept Wandel's claim that the black hole mass to bulge relationship for Seiferts and therefore spirals in general is below that for the
difference? Well, let me show you the Seiferts on this diagram.
Why are the Seiferts so hard? I mean, all you have to do, the Seiferts too have no central source. So that, I don't see why that's a big problem. And
Seiferts
1, those are near
by
objects.
Well, they're dusty.
Oh, that's
they're
that's
spirals. Right. They're dusty. That's and that's they right. Really have no central source?
In Seiferts 2, they're just a little diffuse, you know, light. But in the...
we thought we had to worry about it in 1068.
It can't be that small because Seiferts
identified
it.
Close objects
where
you can just cut those out with a cookie cutter.
Well, yeah. Right, except you have to do that.
Right.
Right.
But you're worried about it being dusty, but can't you discount the IR?
Yep. If the data is obtained, then you do this in the K-band. There isn't K-band photometry. For the objects Wandel discussed yesterday, there isn't K-band photometry for many of those objects. The way he got the bulge luminosities for his objects is he used a ridgeline from Simeon and de Vaucouleurs, where they looked at a bunch of spiral and elliptical galaxies and did this deconstruction, I shouldn't use that word in a scientific talk, the separation into components, and there's enormous scatter, and they put a ridge line through it, and he used their ridge line. Okay, so that's scary.
But you do have to take a caveat, though, that there's definitely a selection effect here, and if you're mainly looking at elliptical balance.
In the Megorian case, absolutely. Absolutely.
And so we know very little about spiral balance.
Well,
for example, 4258 is not a very conservative system.
Which one is 4250? Oh, yes.
That's the major.
Yes.
It's got a very disturbing
effect. Well, I assert that that's what I know about spirals, right? You can see the spirals. They're spirals. Right. But looky here. Let me... Well, actually, I think on our galaxy, the horizontal error bars are pretty small. Right? And this is a sombrero. It's tremendously bulge-dominated. So the horizontal error bars probably aren't so bad. But look here. Here are the Seiferts on this diagram. So these are Seiferts which have been observed, you know, by looking at masers in disks. So I'd say, you know, these are good black hole masses. Here they are. 1, 2, 3. Those are Seiferts. Well, it's a...
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a wimpy AGN, anyway. Well, 1068 is not low luminosity. It's... Yeah.
So if you took out NGC205 and N33, is there any correlation?
Yeah, but it's not very good.
Right.
I agree. It's not very good. That's the data. Okay. So, yeah, so maybe I ought to say something about Wandel's talk. I'm just not sure. I've never yesterday's telling was by far the most convincing case I've ever heard Wandel make. I never took it seriously before. Now I'm worried.
Why are you worried?
Well, you know, as you say, we don't know much about spirals in this part of the diagram, right? It might be interesting to go with that further. The bottom line of Wandel's talk was that if you looked at Seiferts, they sat a factor of 20 under the ridge, or a factor of, yeah, 20, under the ridge line in this diagram. And so if you took that magic number that we often quote, that the black hole mass to the bulge mass is 0.005, he would say it's down by almost a factor of 20, at least for Seifert galaxies.
3 to the minus 4. 3 to the minus 4.
Right. I think that's a fair accounting of his bottom line.
That's what we'd like to pay for then.
Yeah. But again, you can see the 3 Seiferts in this diagram. Well, what I know in these cases, right? If there's a big symbol on these diagrams, it means that Cormody has sat down, and I'm sort of making fun of Cormody, but he's really careful. It means he's examined the light profiles, and he's done the best he can to extract the bulge mass, including, yeah, right. And that's better than just pulling them off the ridge line, which is how they got into Amri's plot. Okay, I've given my entire, I've used up all my time, and I haven't gotten to the interesting stuff. Okay. I'm going to skip the part on stellar breakup flashes. So I think, quasars are almost certainly massive black holes accreting, and these massive dark objects are probably quiescent massive black holes. And so I want to talk about some numerical comparisons with things. So the first point is which I've sort of stealthily presented periodically here, is this quasar background light prediction falls a little below our mean black hole mass per galaxy.
Regarding how far off is both luminosities can be, you know, secrets are SA, SB, and the latest SBC. Couldn't you just, by the Hubble class and the total luminosity, predict the both luminosities for a factor of two?
That's the way he did it.
Okay.
That's the way he did it. He used numbers from Whittle's work, but what Whittle did is he took the Hubble class and he took the mean bulge to total luminosity, which Simeon and de Vaucouleurs worked out in sort of a famous paper in morphology. There's quite a bit of scatter. I don't think it's a factor of 20, but it's certainly a factor of 5. Okay. So now let me talk a little bit about the numbers. So first of all, I have to make the point I got here. So this is the quasar light apportioned per galaxy, and it sits below by about a factor of 5 compared to where you would want to put a ridgeline through there. I don't think that's a problem at all, right? For all the reasons that I discussed, that I discussed, and that everybody had better reasons for at the beginning, right? You could obscure some of the objects. The bolometric corrections that you use to draw this line are probably too small, and so forth. So I regard that as equality for all practical purposes, and you could say that the relic quasars are there, and you can see them, and they're in about the right numbers. The more interesting question is whether Andy Fabian's right, and this basically is the smoking gun that tells you where what the source of the hard X-ray background is. And I actually thought that was a pretty cute idea until I heard Roger's argument against it. So I if you take the light observed in quasars and you multiply it by a factor of 5, that's the energy you need for the hard X-ray background. So if you assume that there are 5 times as many quasars as you actually observe, which is consistent with the black hole demography, then and they're buried so that they're obscured, so you cut off the soft X-rays, then you make about the right hard X-ray background. The problem with that, to the extent that I understand it, which Roger has pointed out, is that you can occult them with lots of matter, but you don't cut off the X-rays harder than 30 or 40 kilovolts. And if they're at a redshift of 3, that gets redshifted back down well into the hard X-ray band, and so it really doesn't work. Unless, I suppose, you use low luminosity quasars at low redshifts.
Actually, low redshift. We had been in discussion before.
It might work in detail.
Not the way it's been presented. Passengers' papers.
Yeah.
Claim to have calculations that could reproduce the hard X-ray spectrum with plausible luminosity.
Oh, right. So that was the point which I didn't understand, which I failed to understand on Tuesday.
They took all of the complete spectra, put in and cut off like
talking about.
Put the redshift distribution in for the Rosette luminosity function, and add it all up and assume that you have some calm density distribution and. for the right column density distribution, right number of squared quasars with the right amount of obscuration, you can sort of get the right thing.
Okay.
But it's all dependent.
Okay. Does he do it by putting them at low redshift, though? Is that a large component to that solution?
It's built into the Rosette luminosity. So,
yeah. And redshift distribution, yeah. Okay. Okay, but I do want to say something about the counts of black holes. Basically, if you count quasars, if you count at least the luminous quasars, the very bright ones, the ones that are 10 to the 46 thirds per second in V, have a number density at their maximum numbers in the universe of about 10 to the minus 6 per co-moving cubic megaparsec for reasonable values of H and unreasonable cosmological models. But for reasonable cosmological models, this only changes by a factor of a couple. So the question is, can you compare this to black holes of some mass, assuming that our demographics are correct?
That's a pretty blunt quasar.
You bet. You bet. This is in fact the luminosity cutoff in the Schmidt-Schneider-Gunn survey. That's why I chose that number. Now that's not what you would deduce just by reading their paper, but this is renormalized to a Hubble constant of 80 and V band, and then you get this number.
What is a quasar? Martin Schmidt woke up one morning and said MV equals minus 23. MV equals
minus 23. Right.
Right.
Quasar. Oh, yeah, these are quasars. Right.
I mean, that is the definition of a quasar.
Well,
we're talking about the same thing as a luminosity function, where one guy said we stopped calling them quasars at some magnitude.
You don't put the extrapolation of luminosity.
No, well, I didn't.
You get that number density, that co-moving number density. It matters when you stop pulling it away, though.
Absolutely. This co-moving number density refers to this luminosity.
That luminosity, and that is not, but that's...
And that means there are more...
Is that a bolometric
collection? Sorry?
Is that a bolometric collection?
No, that's LV.
That's
V.
That's new L in V.
Well, actually, it's you bet it is.
This
is, you bet it is. This is the bright end of the luminosity function.
End, but it, you know, if you went to the faint end, you get many more, infinitely larger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's why I'm very worried about these integral arguments at this stage of the game.
Well,
you really should be comparing objects at the same luminosity or black hole mass.
Well, okay, that's what I'm trying to do. You can decide if this is a problem. I mean, you know, this has its own problems, too.
Yeah.
But let me remind you, you know, in the famous graph that you're used to, this is two famous plots, actually. There's the Nadal plot, right? And there's the standard graph of quasar evolution that you often see. These objects are cut at that luminosity for H not equal 80.
Yeah.
Okay, so this standard plot only refers to the very bright end of the luminosity function as, you know, as I think you understand very well. But
could you do better with the Rosette? Schmidt went much deeper on the Rosette sources. They actually go down a
10-4. Yep.
And the flat, both of them.
Yes, yeah, it's flatter. Yes, yeah. Yes, and there are more objects. Okay. Anyway, let me show you what this leads to. I think it's interesting. So what you have to do is you have to do a bolometric correction for the substantial luminosity, and I took a factor of 10. And then I assumed, because this is the bright end of the luminosity function, that these are Eddington accretors. Okay, that is, that they're at Eddington luminosity. Now, they may not be, but I claim if you have a luminosity function and you have objects that are accreting at various little m dots, the brightest ones are likely to be closest to Eddington luminous. So that's the assumption. If you take that mass and put a ridgeline through these objects, right? This is like Mark Twain says, this is enormous results from extrapolation, right? Put a ridgeline through these objects and ask yourself what kind of galaxy corresponds to a mass of 5 by 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole. You identify a bulge luminosity of the host galaxy, and then you can estimate from Schechter modified by Bengeli luminosity functions how many of them there are, and there are 10 to the minus 3 per cubic megaparsec. Okay, so that I claim, so that's the count, that is a counting problem, right? If you count the quasars, they're 10 to the minus 6 per cubic megaparsec. If I make what I think are sensible assumptions about the bolometric correction and the mass of the underlying black holes, and I say, okay, let me compare that to the host galaxy population, the host galaxies, and therefore, if we're right, the mass of black holes are 10 cubed times more numerous than the quasars at their sort of at the peak of their existence. You read this off this side.
If you went down to 10 to the 44, like Powell was just mentioning, would that come out to be order 1?
I don't know. Let's look at that.
I would say I think you can do that.
And the greater of all of those that. I thought it was close. For the number of black holes.
But you should compare to smaller galaxies, though, because you've got smaller black holes. The problem that I have with doing that is, you know, the further you go down the luminosity function, the more nervous you've got to be about assuming that they're Eddington accretors. And Omer, I think, can maybe tell me how to guess from their spectrum what M dot is, or maybe other people can tell me how to guess what M dot is. Or okay, but that's the problem, right? The further you go down the luminosity function, the more concerned you should be that the black holes are really more massive than you think, and that you're looking at a sub-Eddington accretor.
But at least it's a very clean assumption.
Well, let's look at the numbers. You're around for another couple of days, right? Okay. So we'll look back at those numbers.
I mean, just to emphasize, you have re-emphasized what you have said. You have a depressing the large amount of leeway in both the volumetric correction and factors relative to something that you can measure accurately and in the efficiency of accretion. And if you believe that the counting of beams is an operation that astronomers can perform more carefully than guessing about, you know, epsilons and deltas and so on, then you can make them fit, I believe. You can make the progenitors of the black holes that we observe around us, the quasars at large redshifts and the secrets at lower redshifts that we actually see, plus the objects that
yes, I can make them fit if I crank up the bolometric correction by a factor of 10. Right. That's right.
Right.
That's what it takes.
And that's, yeah.
So that becomes a factor of 100.
Well, again, you've got the efficiency as well as another factor.
Yes, that's right. I could assume there were sub-Eddington accretors.
Right. I mean, I think you're right to do it by trying to compare light objects. To ask the question, what has 3C9 become? What was M31 in the past?
Fair enough.
You know, make those, how many M31s are there, how many 3C9s are there, and, you know, try and make those direct identifications. Because that, you know, that, and this we're hopefully running cosmology, that identification should be the one that we should be able to be
flashing on them.
How do I know?
Much about the moment.
How do I know that M31 looks like 3C9?
No, no, it doesn't. There's two separate questions.
Oh, you're saying how many M31s there are?
Let's rank all the galaxies and rank all the AGN as we can see them.
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. You're saying I shouldn't go at it this way. I should say, what's NQ as a function of L?
Yes.
And what's this as a function of M?
And assuming that it's monotonic, we may not know how to move the AGN or quasar scale versus the galaxy.
And count them down from the top.
From the top as a cumulative distribution function.
Well, that's a reasonable exercise.
Well, we did this.
So. Oh. You did?
Yeah. I mean, it's smaller than I tried to do.
Okay.
Okay. Anyway, this way, there's a bottom line.
And the bottom line is there's a 10 to the third problem.
Can I ask another question?
Yeah.
Sorry. But you're assuming you've got the spheroids assembled at redshift of 3 in this or not?
Ah, no. I mean, that's one of the ways out.
Well, there's problems, maybe. But the sense out there, then you're going to go when you're going to.
That's right. That's right.
If you go down a long way, you might actually, in any model that you can think of that's reasonable,
let me say something about it. I'm not sure where you're going, but I think I'm going the same place. So let me say a little bit more.
The active photons emitted then the unit Bose luminosity now.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right.
Rather than because it's.
That's right. Okay. That's right.
Right.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And the fudge factor you have to put in is 1 plus Z emission. But. Okay. So. One way out of this problem, if you take this number at face value, one way out is you have a very short duty cycle of 10 to the minus 3. And since you examine an epoch at a redshift around 3 that's around 10 to the 9 years long, that implies that the objects have a lifetime, have a total lifetime while bright of about 10 to the 6 years, which is a lot less than the saltpeter time. Which implies that you don't observe most of the assembly of the objects. And I think, you know, short duty cycles have been suggested by a number of other authors. This makes me acutely uncomfortable, but that's one explanation.
I think you can argue against the short duty cycles in the case of the extended radius.
Right. I'm not sure that any other strong direct argument against that.
That is, those have to have been on for 10 to the 8 years in order to get the, in order to still be shining.
Right. Not
given the
right.
You never see a coreless one.
You have to see a coreless one, and it'd be hard to make it up.
Well, how do you get? Wait. How do you get? How do you get 10 to the 8 years out of that? They're only a megaparsec out.
Well, I'm not saying that they're expanding much more slowly.
Point one
to zero. The duty cycles can be about 10% in radio galaxies. It may not be a problem that you don't see a coreless one because Chris Reynolds and I were doing a very simple model for the emissivity in the radio, and the radio emissions fade very quickly. The radio emissions of a radio galaxy will turn off almost instantly when the source goes off, except at low frequencies. The hot spot disappears
It's not the fact that you see a core. It's the fact that the lobes are a megaparsec out. That tells you that it's 10 to the 7 years old.
Yeah, so it's 10 to 7. I'm just saying that's probably the best. I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
It's the best we can do.
Okay.
So if indeed, so what if they go here and they have a crack, if the duty cycle of the crack, they could be 10 to 6. I don't know that they can draw in skirts for.
Then you see coreless quasar.
Well, actually, I think if the duty cycle were quite short, you would never see big radio lobes because you couldn't power them long enough to get them out to about a megaparsec.
Yeah.
So the point that they're coreless or not is sort of not the key point. It's the point that they're big.
You went for 10 to 8 years, but in spurts of 10 to 6, I mean.
Yeah, but the point is, sorry. I mean, I didn't make that...
You see the compact radius when you see the lamp.
And...
Wait, but you don't know what the power of the compact radio source is.
I mean, what do you
do? Yeah, but
it may be unlikely that they turn off completely, but they could become much weaker.
Yeah, but then they wouldn't continue to drive the thing outward, right? It would run out of steam very quickly.
What's the electron life button before?
I mean,
short.
Yeah.
Short.
And then
but area.
Yeah.
Let me make one more point. The other way out of this is to assume that the black holes have a couple of epochs of, have a couple of mergers since the black hole epoch. And I think that's very reasonable for a whole number of reasons that I could argue. But if you believe that happens then, it's completely reasonable to suppose that it doesn't start then and that you might build the black holes up by hierarchical merging, at least for a substantial fraction of their growth. And if that's true, you can see it. And that's the last point that I want to make, because if you build LISA, the space interferometric laser interferometric space array, which is in strain, if it works, in strain is supposed to be about as sensitive as LIGO, but its frequency response is around 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 hertz instead of 10 squared hertz. So this is a low frequency gravity wave detector. And that means you can observe the death spiral of massive black holes instead of tiny ordinary mass black holes. And the interesting thing, which I only recently learned, I think other people knew quite a bit, is that gravitational radiation redshifts very gracefully. Because, I mean, it's much, much better than photons because the power goes as omega squared h squared because h, the strain, is the potential. And what that means is if you apply the way I think about this, which is a terribly inelegant way to think about it, is if you use the bolometric luminosity distance formula, two powers of 1 plus z get soaked up by the redshift in the frequency. And then you observe not the flux in the wave, but or the rest of it, but the square root of it, because you measure the strain directly. And so if you have 10 to the fifth on 10 to the fifth Schwarzschild black holes, even at a redshift of 1,000, you could plausibly detect the gravitational rays, certainly at a redshift of 100, if there are any of them out there. And for more massive objects, you can detect them to quite substantial redshifts. In fact, they don't get much fainter. They just redshift out of your bandpass. So so if these things really do merge, if they form, well, if there's a substantial quadrupole movement, but even better, if they form by some sort of hierarchical merging scenario, you ought to be able to see them easily. That was the last point. That was the last new point I wanted to make. Well, for the objects that you can see, the simplest way to do this calculation is there are 10 to the 10 galaxies in our light cone. Right? If you looked at the sky with sensitive eyes, you'd see 10 to the 10 galaxies. And since the redshift of 3, when you see the quasars, the typical galaxy has merged once or twice, and so if the black holes go with them, then it's about one per year, right? Because that's 10 to the 10 in a Hubble time. And you can sharpen that argument with Preschecter theory, and I don't think you should believe it. But the key point is that those objects are 10 to the 8th solar mass black holes, which you probably won't see. So that's not, right, because they're they're sufficiently long waves that you're not likely to see very much of that. The really interesting sources are the objects which build up to those at higher redshift, and you know, the merger rate for those is likely, certainly could easily be higher if the objects form hierarchically.
You don't know if they've got black holes in them at that point.
Yeah, but I know the black holes have to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
But you also have to worry about the Nabokov friction
constant. Yeah, yeah. I've got another half hour talk on that. I mean, basically, if they're 10 to the 6th, you can be reasonably confident they'll get to the center. That's right.
And in low mass galaxies, they keep longer.
No, because they're denser.
But they're denser, right?
Exactly, they're denser. So it's actually.
More black hole in a Milky Way galaxy.
That's right. But that's right. Here's the bad spot, right? The first problem, your first problem is to get it in from the halo. This is A dot over A, right? The rate at which you decay. So, first of all, it depends on how low down in the halo the black hole comes apart from the rest of the galaxy. If it comes apart quickly, it could get hung up in the halo. But if you get down to a couple of parsecs in a galaxy like ours, sorry, a couple of kiloparsecs, then you go down, that's somewhere around here, then you go down by dynamical friction pretty quickly, and then you become a hard binary with the black hole that's already there.
What do you assume about the black hole mass and the density of the stars in the galaxy here? What's going
on? In this case, I graphed it for our galaxy, for the bulge of our galaxy.
With a
10 to the 7, well, here's the point at which it hangs up. I thought about a million solar mass object, but the point at which the worst point is in our galaxy is as the binary gets hard, harder and harder until gravitational radiation takes over. And for the Milky Way, that number is around 10 to the 6th solar masses. But if the galaxy's denser, as Piero says, then you can accrete a lower mass black hole.
Okay, but the 10 to the 5 solar masses, you know how much I want this to work.
10 to the 5 solar masses would probably not accrete all the way down to the bottom in our galaxy. But 10 to the 6th would.
Comment here on what happens in young stars. The youngest, the way the solar mass stars are presumed to form, and there's lots of evidence that they may form through a series of eukaryotic stars. So most of the lifetime they are inferred to the fission rates, which are like 2 orders of magnitude lower than when they go through the high phase, and the high phase is about 10% of the star.
You're saying I shouldn't worry about this short duty cycle.